Hi, it's Anushka. I've got an update for those of you who listened to our Freshwater series about five men sentenced to a combined total of 104 years after being found guilty of a conspiracy to import cocaine into the UK. Yesterday, we had news that was devastating for the men and their families. They lost at the Court of Appeal after three judges decided to uphold their conviction. We've been speaking to all the key people involved so that we can bring you an episode on what happened on Monday. But first today, Rachel has interviewed Caitlin McNamara, who is fighting for justice a year after she alleges she was raped by a member of the Emirati royal family.
Over the past few weeks, many women have shared their experiences of sexual assault.
I think so often we hear about sexual violence or we're starting to hear about sexual violence, but you rarely hear about the aftermath and just how, I mean, this has been a full-time job for a year now, really, dealing with this. And I don't think that's talked about enough.
Caitlin McNamara was launching a literary festival in the UAE when she says she was attacked by an immensely powerful man. This is not the story of what she claims happened to her one afternoon last February, but the impact it has had on her life since. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the aftermath of a rape 1 year on. Caitlin grew up in the market town of Hay-on-Wye on the Welsh border, and since she was a teenager, had been part of the team that ran the literary festival that takes place there every year. At the end of 2019, she was asked by the festival's director, Peter Florence, to go to Abu Dhabi, where they were launching an Arabic version of the event. Initially, Caitlin was unsure about accepting the offer.
I was 30 at the time, and I had spent the last decade working, living and studying abroad, often in the Middle East. I'd worked on campaigning in Syria for the White Helmets. I'd lived in Damascus, in Beirut, and also in France and Belgium. And I really loved being home, and I was sort of hesitant to move abroad again.
But in the end, you did decide to take the job and went out to Abu Dhabi. What was it like when you got there?
I mean, it was just a world away from my life in London. I was put up in this sort of very glitzy five-star hotel overlooking the sort of Arabian Sea, and I had a chauffeur, and it was also extremely chaotic. Shortly after I arrived, I got told that my contract with Hay Festival was void, and I was actually working for the Ministry of Tolerance, UAE Ministry of Tolerance, who were sponsoring the festival. And that was pretty distressing because, you know, I had not signed up to work for the UAE government and I had quite strong feelings about that. But at this point, I had already, you know, rented out my flat in London and relocated at great expense. So I just thought it was just for 6 months and I'd make the most of it.
What was it like working in this environment as a woman?
Fine. I mean, in my experience of working across the Arab world, I've rarely had trouble with my gender. In fact, the only person that ever commented about my clothes was an American man. You know, I mean, there was definitely a sort of a hierarchy in which men came before women, but I think being a foreigner and someone who speaks Arabic, allowances were made for me in that I could go into quite male-dominated spaces and be treated as an equal.
The festival that you were working on, how did that go? I mean, you managed to book some pretty high-profile guests for it, didn't you?
Yeah, so it was difficult 6 months, but myself and the team managed to build an event to be proud of. We had 80 writers and artists and performers coming in to Abu Dhabi from around the world, really. We managed to reach over 80 schools within the UAE. So I was really, really looking forward to it.
And it sounds then like you wanted this festival to be more than just a platform for writers to talk about their work. It had a social aim to it as well.
I knew in taking the job that I wanted to do everything I could to have a clear conscience about hosting a festival that celebrates freedom of expression in a country that regularly locks up prisoners of conscience. And we had attracted criticism, and rightly so. Much of this centred around an Emirati poet, human rights activist and father of four called Ahmed Mansour, who remains in solitary confinement several miles from where the festival was taking place. Hay Festival had been working with various human rights organisations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, quietly behind the scenes, to see how we could help his cause, help him, and also perhaps encourage the Ministry of Tolerance to, you know, actually start practicing that tolerance that they were preaching.
So you were working behind the scenes to help the poet Ahmed Mansour. What response did you get to that?
There was a campaign about reading his poetry out on stage, and I wanted to make sure that everyone was safe to do that. So I'd had this pretty frank meeting with the ministry about that. And the following day, my boss was told that we had perhaps gone a little bit too far. And shortly afterwards, I received a call from the Minister of Tolerance, a man called Sheikh Nayan.
He invited you to a meeting. How did you feel about that?
I mean, he was the head of the organisation that I worked for and also a senior royal. It wasn't a request, it was a sort of demand, come for a meeting. But I didn't really think anything of it. I thought it would be an attempt to get the festival to drop its campaigning efforts.
That meeting turned out to be something that Caitlin has had to retell and replay in her mind many times. She was picked up by the Sheikh chauffeur, and in the car, she texted Peter Florence and switched on her WhatsApp tracker so he knew where she was. She thought the meeting would take place at the Sheikh's palace in town, but instead, she says she was driven to a more remote location, a villa on a small private island. When she went inside, she says her phone was taken away. The Sheikh offered her a glass of wine, which would usually be prohibited in the UAE. Caitlin says it quickly became clear that he didn't see this as a business meeting. For 4 hours, she was trapped. It was during this time that Caitlin says the Sheikh raped her.
Immediately, the festival came to mind. I was sort of so conscious that this was a man with immense power over this thing that I and the whole team had worked so hard to build. And in my experience, people with a lot of power, or men with a lot of power, don't take rejection well. And I'd heard the horror stories about the UAE, about, you know, people being dumped in the desert and all of these things. And suddenly those stories that had seemed so exaggerated and silly when someone else was telling me became very real in my head. And it was, how do I get out of there safely without messing up anything for the festival or offending this man?
I think that is what I find so heartbreaking about your account, Caitlin, and what so many women say in these situations, because you were trying to take everything on for everyone. You know, you were compensating, you were trying to think of him and think of the festival, and it was only at the end, really, that you thought of yourself. And I feel like women do this so much, and it's so upsetting to me hearing that again and again in these stories.
Yeah, it's a tragedy, really, and it's only, I mean, I was willing to put that ahead of myself to the point that, like, the ultimate violence happened to me. You know, I think perpetrators of like this are very aware of that dynamic, and that's why they so often get away with it.
When you did manage to leave the Sheikh's villa, you finally left, what was going through your mind?
I got given my phone back at the end, so I had all these missed calls and messages from my boss, and he was obviously really concerned. In the car, I just was on edge. I was looking, you know, at what the driver looked like. I was looking at where we were going. I didn't know if I was going back to my hotel or not. I think that's something that isn't talked about enough, in that quite often in these things, the violence isn't just physical. What happens to you physically is horrific, but it's also just being on edge for that amount of time, really not knowing what the next minute will hold, and constantly preempt the next thing and do a sort of safety inventory of, you know, are the car doors locked? Where are we going? Where are we? It's exhausting and you know, really psychologically scarring.
You said that your boss, Peter Florence, had been calling you. When you did speak to him, what did he say?
He had told me to come home. You know, I was really struggling to articulate what had happened. So, you know, that night I stayed up the rest of the night weighing up what to do. And in the morning, the sheikh started calling me, and I knew that not answering a sheikh's calls was not a good thing. I mean, this man was deified, and for 6 months I'd seen people sort of, you know, bow down at his every whim, and the fact that I was ignoring these calls was terrifying. So I went to Dubai and hid out at a hotel under a fake name so that I could report what happened to the British consulate.
You went to Dubai and you did meet with someone from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. What did they suggest you do?
The advice from the Foreign Commonwealth Office was to be with my support network back in the UK. They gave me the contact of a rape crisis centre in the UK. They also gave me the contact of a lawyer who told me, when I called that lawyer, they said that because of the status of this man, they wouldn't be able to touch my case. And they did offer support getting me onto the plane safely. And that was it.
You were told to leave the country, as you say, for your own safety. So you went to Oman. This was before you came back to the UK. And while you were there, the festival that you'd spent months working on took place. What was that like for you?
When I was in Oman, it was definitely a turning point for me. I remember very clearly that it was the Weinstein conviction. I was sitting on a bed in my hotel room and I was watching Weinstein being convicted on the hotel TV. And then on my phone and laptop, I could see, you know, all these festival emails coming through, and I could see on Instagram the man who had hurt me being applauded and taking credit for this thing that I had worked really hard to build with the team. And, you know, I think that was the moment that I allowed myself to be angry.
You came back to the UK, Caitlin, and you told your friends and family about what had happened to you. How did they respond?
So I arrived back to the UK the day before the first lockdown started. So my story has to be told kind of within the context of that, because it was such a strange time when everyone was panicking. Our whole world had been sort of flipped upside down. And I arrived back into the midst of that. And how I see it is that, you know, I had the initial violence that happened to me in Abu Dhabi, and the next few months were just an additional trauma, in that I knew what had happened to me was really wrong, but what I was getting reflected back at me, I just couldn't almost have that validated by anyone. And I don't know if that's because of the pandemic or sort of our society's conditioning around how we listen to and deal with stories of sexual violence. My family are liberal, supportive, loving, and yet the message by and large was, this is an awful thing that happened to you, but he's way too powerful to be held accountable.
In the months after you got back, how did you begin to process what had happened to you?
I couldn't call it what it was for some time. I couldn't call it rape, and it was later argued by my lawyers as torture. I couldn't call it what it was for a long time. You know, I tried calling rape crisis centres, and as supportive as they were, they're massively underfunded. So all I could do was get on a waiting list to get on another waiting list to access help. The lawyer that I contacted asked for more money than I earn in a year to initiate criminal proceedings. You know, Hay Festival were dealing with the pandemic. So, you know, I was made unemployed from them. And it was really, really frightening. I was really distressed that no one, I was sort of telling anyone I could about what happened, and no one seemed to be listening to me. So I began sort of questioning myself, you know, was it really that bad? Or maybe I'm making too much of a fuss. And the physical side of that was just like a dark place. I started sort of picking up my skin and having panic attacks, this nightmare of his weight on top of me. You know, I was very scared for my safety, but I just couldn't access the help that I needed.
As you've said, you did seek professional support to help you deal with all of this. What was that process like for you?
So I was eventually able to access help. I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I had great help on the NHS and privately as well. I started taking medication and also had therapy, which was a great help. But for me, the moment I spoke publicly about what had happened, a huge weight was lifted. You know, all of that sort of fear and fury just dissipated by shining a spotlight on what had happened. You know, I was no longer protecting him with my silence.
After this, the challenges Caitlin has faced in pursuing a criminal case against the Sheikh. For the past year, Caitlin has been trying to get justice for what she says happened to her. Her former boss, Peter Florence, put her in touch with Baroness Helena Kennedy QC, one of the most prominent lawyers in the country, and she offered to take on Caitlin's case.
Once I was able to access help from Baroness Kennedy, who is just, I think, the most incredible human being, I went to Scotland Yard to give a video interview of what happened. And to me, the Met Police were wonderful. I was immediately seen by two female detectives. I gave a lengthy video interview, and on the basis of, at the time, what was just my story alone, they made the decision to install panic alarms in my home, and also a detective checked in on me on a weekly basis.
I mean, that sounds terrifying. Did you manage to make some progress, though, with the legal case? Where is that now?
So after reporting it to the Metropolitan Police, that went forward to the Crown Prosecution Service. The Crown Prosecution Service were satisfied that the assault would constitute rape had it happened in the UK, but because it had to fit within international law, because it happened abroad, it met two of the three criteria, but they weren't satisfied with the third, which is that this man, Sheikh Nayan, was acting in performance of his official duties at the time of the assault, and therefore they denied it being put forward as a criminal case, which was heartbreaking, because that's all I've ever really wanted, was just to have it in front of a judge, for a judge to make that decision rather than the CPS.
You've been told then that you can't pursue this as a criminal case and will have to go through the civil courts. How do you feel about that?
When this idea was first offered to me, I was like disgusted by it. I thought the idea of putting a price on the pain and powerlessness I felt. And I was terrified of being called, you know, if I tried to claim damages, of being called a gold digger. And I think after a long year of learning from really inspirational campaigners like Baroness Kennedy and speaking to other survivors, I've completely changed my ideas of claiming civil damages for sexual violence when it comes to women's bodies. There's still a stigma around it. And yet, when I think about, you know, I've had my entire life upended by this, so have my family. I have to carry around, you know, forever, whenever any future employers or anyone I meet Googles my name, it will be the first thing that comes up.
In the past couple of weeks, we've been thinking a lot about violence against women in the wake of the Sarah Everard case, which has led to thousands of women sharing their experiences of harassment, assault and rape. How have you felt watching this play out?
I think it's highlighted something that, you know, I've been trying to say for the last year, in that the law, whether that's English law or international law, just isn't equipped. These acts of violence against women that happen all day, every day, just slip through the net of the law. You know, unless something horrific happens, there's a lot of work going into changing that, but those changes aren't happening fast enough. So whilst we sort of continue to sort of fight this exhausting, never-ending fight for the law to catch up with women's realities, I think it's why it's so important to, if you're safe enough to do so and well enough to do so, which shouldn't be taken for granted, we need to speak up about our experiences.
A lot of people say that this comes down to education, that boys should be taught from birth to respect women as equals. What do you think our society needs to do now?
I think as much as this much needed movement to empower women to be able to tell their stories safely and be believed, that's obviously so important, but we also do need to start listening to the stories of men. I would love to know, something I've thought quite a lot about in the last year, is what this man told himself when he was doing what he did to me, and what he told himself the next day and in the weeks and months afterwards. You know, how he justified doing that to himself. This man, Sheikh Nayan, and I, we live in completely different realities. And it's really, it's not impossible to imagine that he truly might not be aware of the consequences of his actions. I mean, he's surrounded by yes men that deify him. And in a society that really trains men to believe that they have to objectify and you know, conquer women as prizes. And I don't think, again, that's not an Emirati problem, that's a global one. So until we start kind of shifting those narratives and, you know, listening to those stories, we'll never be able to get to the root of the problem and find the much, much needed, long overdue solution for it.
Caitlin, I'm so grateful to you for speaking to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Caitlin McNamara. You can read an article she wrote about what this past year has been like for her at theguardian.com. We contacted Sheikh Nayan bin Mubarak al-Nayan several times about this podcast and received no response. He has previously denied Caitlin's allegations. The Hay Festival issued this statement. What happened to our colleague and friend, Caitlin McNamara, in Abu Dhabi last February was an appalling violation and a hideous abuse of trust and position. Sheikh Nayan bin Mubarak al-Nayan made a mockery of his ministerial responsibilities. The Crown Prosecution Service's decision that they have no jurisdiction to prosecute Sheikh Nayan is deeply disappointing. We support Caitlin's decision to seek legal redress against him for this attack, and we urge our friends and partners around the world to send a clear signal that such behaviour will not be tolerated. We also approached the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, and a spokesperson said, "We take any reports of sexual assault abroad extremely seriously. Our staff remain in contact with Miss McNamara, and we will continue to do everything we can to support her. Our consular support is always designed to meet the best interests of the people we are helping. No other factors in our decision-making are involved. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore, and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.